Isaiah, Chapter 36, the 24th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on August 18, 2013, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 2, The Siege of Lachish, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at Isaiah chapters 36 and 37. As I mentioned last week, we have a four-chapter section here in Isaiah. It's kind of a transition section. It's kind of a bridge between the two parts of Isaiah. And the first part of Isaiah has been talking about Israel's surrounding enemies. And in the backdrop of all of what's been said has been the fear that Assyria would be coming militarily, that they were going to come and conquer the area. Where it's going to be significantly different when we get into chapter 40 and through the rest of Isaiah. It changes both in theme and in tone. And this four-chapter section right in the middle is the bridge between those two. So these first two chapters of this four-chapter section, 36 and 37, talk about when Assyria did come. And then the next two chapters are going to talk about first Hezekiah's sickness and his miraculous healing, and then it's going to talk about the Babylonians coming to look at the treasures in the temple. And that's going to be the bridge to the last part of Isaiah, where Babylon is more in view rather than Assyria. It's not often in teaching the Old Testament that one can use contemporary texts as well as contemporary art to illustrate what's being talked about. So I wanted to take advantage of this opportunity and my superior technical skills and put together a slideshow, a PowerPoint show that I can show you some of this stuff. There's a lot more on the internet if you are interested, and I've got one of these slides has one address. But there are lots of places that you can go. There are a lot of images that are available. We have, to illustrate this event, that is, when Assyria attacks not just the Levant, but attacks Judea specifically, we have a written text, and we'll look at that in just a minute, from the time. We also have an account preserved by Herodotus, who is writing probably 100 years later after the event. And it's a little bit garbled, but it preserves some of the features of this event. And then we have engravings that were found in a temple in Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, that depict the conquest of Lachish. Lachish was the second largest city in Judea and the second most stoutly defended of the cities in Judea. And so we have engravings that enshrine that event. So we'll look at those. Okay, let's look at the first slide. This is the prism of Sennacherib. There are actually two accounts that have been preserved of this event. I've forgotten whether they are exactly the same or whether they differ at some points. But this one has I think it's six columns, and it talks about Sennacherib's expedition to the Levant and what happened. And it talks about the places where he goes, what happens there, and then moves on to the next location. One of those locations is Judea. The next slide. I have just taken the text that is relevant to Palestine, and I'll read through this quickly. So this is from the end of column 2. It says, the officials, nobles, and people of Ekron. Ekron would have been one of the 5 Philistine cities on the coast. And Ekron was allied with Judea. We'll see. The officials, nobles, and people of Ekron, who had thrown Padi, their king, bound by oath and curse of Assyria, into fetters of iron, and had given him over to Hezekiah the Judahite, he kept him in confinement like an enemy. Their hearts became afraid, and they called upon the Egyptian kings, the bowmen, chariots, and horses of the king of Melua, Ethiopia, a countless host, and these came to their aid in the neighborhood of El-Takeh, their ranks being drawn up before me. Ekron is apparently one of those Philistine cities that Hezekiah wanted to join him in the alliance against Assyria. And the king of Ekron obviously didn't want to go along with that. And the people of Ekron turned him over to Hezekiah. Hezekiah took him as a captive in Jerusalem. And the people of Ekron then were on the side of Judea with Hezekiah. The people of Ekron, as is true of Hezekiah, were counting on help from the Egyptians. And the Egyptians came. He says, and they called upon the Egyptian kings, the bowmen, chariots, and the horses of the king of Melua, Ethiopia, which would have been Cush. Ethiopia and Cush were united by this time. So they have come, and they come to El-Takeh, and I think the next slide shows what happens there. They offered battle with the aid of, and that's the name of some god transliterated from Assyrian, and I don't know what that is. With the aid of this god, my lord, I fought with them and brought about their defeat. The Egyptian charioteers and princes, together with the Ethiopian king's charioteers, my hands captured alive in the midst of the battle. El-Takeh and Timnah I besieged, I captured, and I took away their spoil. I approached Ekron and slew the governors and nobles who had rebelled and hung their bodies on stakes around the city. The inhabitants who rebelled and treated Assyria lightly, I counted as spoil. The rest of them, who were not guilty of rebellion and contempt, for whom there was no punishment, I declared their pardon. Padi, their king, I brought out to Jerusalem, set him on the royal throne over them, and imposed upon him my royal tribute. So, he defeats the Egyptian army at El-Takeh, and then he besieges Timnah and El-Takeh, and then he takes Ekron. And of particular note, all of the leaders of Ekron he takes out, and he kills them. That was the Assyrian way. It was repeated by many different conquering armies in history after that, and probably even before that. But part of the strategy is an enormous amount of intimidation. Anybody who put up resistance to Assyria, they would treat absolutely ruthlessly in hopes that the next city would give up rather than suffer that kind of treatment. So in particular, they would single out the leaders of the cities and torture them and kill them. And we'll see slides of that in a bit. Oh, my goodness. As for Hezekiah the Judahite, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong walled cities, as well as the small towns in their area, which were without number, by leveling with battering rams, and by bringing up siege engines, and by attacking and storming on foot, by mines, tunnels, and breaches, I besieged and took them. 200,150 people great and small, male and female, horses, mules, asses, camels, cattle, and sheep without number, I brought away from them and counted as spoil. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. I threw up earthworks against him. The one coming out of the city gate, I turned back to his misery. His cities, which I despoiled, I cut off from his land. And to Mitinti, king of Ashdod, Padi, king of Ekron, and Silly Bell, is that what it says? King of Gaza, I gave them, and thus I diminished his land. I added to the former tribute, and I laid upon him the surrender of their land and imposts, gifts for my majesty, As for Hezekiah, the terrifying splendor of my majesty overcame him, and the Arabs and his mercenary troops, which he had brought to strengthen Jerusalem, his royal city, deserted him. In addition to the 30 talents of gold and 800 talents of silver, gems, antimony, jewels, large carnelians, ivory inlaid couches, ivory inlaid chairs, elephant hides, elephant tusks, ebony, boxwood, all kinds of valuable treasures, as well as his daughters, his harem, his male and female musicians, which he had brought after me to Nineveh, my royal city. To pay tribute and to accept servitude, he dispatched his messengers. So that's the Assyrian account of what happened when Assyria comes to Judea. We'll see that as compared to the biblical account, this has been spun a little bit, and we'll see that. Okay, next one. Okay, here, if you want to see images or other information, just Google Lachish or Google Image Lachish, and there's lots there. But the most interesting one, it has a number of pictures, and it explains the pictures. I found it very helpful. It's at Odyssey Adventures. So if you want to see those, go there. Next. Okay, here's the Assyrian Empire. It stretches from the Persian Gulf to the Levant. It was, of that time, it was the largest empire that had ever been established. You can see where Nineveh is. That's in present-day Iraq, near the area where Kirkuk is located. Then you can see Lachish, which is the city that we have the graphics for, the second largest city in Judea, and we'll see where that is in the next slide. Here's a map that shows you just Judea. And you can see where Jerusalem is, just west of Jericho. And then Lachish is southwest of Jerusalem. Not very far. And then about halfway between is Livnah. And we'll see that in the text in just a little bit. Next one. This is the Tell as it looks today. An overhead view of the Tell Lachish. It's not developed. It has been excavated to a certain extent, and they've made it into a national park. You can go and visit it and walk around the ruins. Here's another view at a different time of year, but it's a little bit more. You can see the steep walls on the Tell. Here is a map looking down on Tell Lachish, and of particular significance for our purposes is apparently the city was quite formidable, but the place where the walls were the lowest and where it was most vulnerable were on what is the lower right-hand corner. And you'll notice there that the city gate is located almost there. And in typical fashion in this time. The gates, you would come in a long causeway and then make a sharp right-hand turn. And they did that so that you could not come in with speed. And they would put their archers right at that corner, and when people had to slow down, then they'd just shoot them with arrows. So the gate would have been very heavily fortified, but it's right next to the gate that the walls are the most vulnerable. Next one. Here it shows you an illustration of the city as it existed, and now you see the gate in the lower left-hand corner. Notice that there are double walls with the city inside of that. And here again, this is a drawing that's a little bit more from the side. You see the gate again, and the city, the houses in the city, the palace in the city. Now here's a reconstruction, and again, we're looking at the city gate. And you can get a better feel for how that gate works. As soon as you get in the gate, then that's the main street through Lachish. Now, this is the entrance to the room in the palace in Nineveh where the reliefs that we'd be looking at were carved. They were carved all around the room. In earlier Assyrian art, they would typically have, like in a comic strip, it would have these little boxes next to each other, and you know that time passes between them. In this one, there are no boxes, but it just progresses chronologically around the room. So you see the beginning of the siege on your left-hand side, and as you go around, it gets further and further into the siege until the end of the siege on the right-hand side of the room. And this palace this room had special adornment on it. And right in the entrance, there are lions on both sides of the wall. And archaeologists think that there was some special significance attached to this room, leading one to believe that the siege of Lachish was a very significant event in this expedition. This may be difficult to see from the back of the room, but these are Assyrian slingers. They had slings that they would throw rocks with. They have found a number of the stones that they threw with the slings, and they're about a little bit bigger than billiard balls. And the slingers could be very accurate, and they were a significant part of the military. Here we see the archers, another significant part of the military, and these engravings have a lot of archers in the army. I'll point out the Assyrians took great pride in their military prowess. They had people trained for all kinds of things. They had people trained to undermine city walls. They had people trained to do underwater work. They had people trained to to build and operate siege engines. They had people trained to take countermeasures against whatever the city does to defend itself, like throwing down fire or whatever it is. They took great pride in being prepared for any contingency. Here we see, this is a drawing based on the engravings. I could have put the engravings, but they weren't as clear. It was harder to see what the images were. Here is a drawing based on it. Now, there are going to be two close-ups of portions of the attack, and we'll look at both of those, and then there's one that shows the attack in general. The things of particular interest here are we see the attacking Assyrians on the bottom two rows. We have spearmen. They had short spears, and the spears were not for throwing. They were like bayonets. When they got close, they were used for hand-to-hand fighting. They've got shields. The shields, if you could see it well enough, it's a woven sticks, probably reeds or something. And they think that it must have been covered either with metal or with leather, because a wicker shield was not very effective. But the wicker part of it was just the framework. Then you see up on the city walls, you see the defenders. We have archers and other people up on the walls, and you see a few projectiles look like stones being thrown probably by the slingers. Here we've got another scene. These are more attackers. They're all going uphill. We've got a chariot here. Notice up at the top, it has what look like palm trees and then some other kind of vegetation. The vegetation that it shows, and then we'll see in another engraving, there are these bumps that stand for mountains. And they say that in Assyrian artwork, when you combine the palms and the vines and the mountains, that tells you that the area is the Levant. It's either Lebanon or it's Palestine. Now, this will be harder to see, but those two are both close-ups from this. So you can see the attacking forces coming up from two different sides. You see the city walls just teeming with defenders at the top. I don't know if you can, you probably can't tell, but there are the attacking army. The soldiers have two different kinds of helmets. Some of them have the cone-shaped ones, and the others have a less pronounced cone-shaped helmet with a little adornment on the top. The ones that are cone-shaped, those are Assyrian forces. They aren't sure what the others are, but they suspect that those are Greek mercenaries, which would be interesting because that would mean that Greek mercenaries were getting out early. This is 700 BC. Now, in that last one, if we could, we didn't have a close-up of these, but there were siege engines that you could see, and we'll get close-ups of them in just a minute. The way that they took Lachish was they built a ramp at that spot that I've pointed out was the weak spot. They built a ramp that allowed them to go right over the wall. And they did so by moving large stones into place. And once they got the basic framework of this ramp built, then they brought in smaller stones. And they end up with gravel with a kind of concrete type mix that made a very smooth ramp going up to the wall. And they needed that because their siege engines have wheels and they needed a smooth surface on which to travel. Here's what remains. You can't see it very well, but here's what remains. There is a bit of the ramp that is still visible, and that's how they were able to determine how this ramp was built. Okay, here on the top two rows of attackers, at the front of those rows, each one has a siege engine. Let's go to the next one. I think the next one you can see it. Okay, there's a siege engine. It's right there. It looks like a wood stove on wheels with a little pointy thing coming out the front of it. So they would wheel that up to the wall, and that pointy thing was apparently a beam that could be maneuvered and pounded into the wall. This shows you the aftermath of this and the victory. Oh, let's go back. Let's go back one more. No, you can see it here. If you look just below the city walls, those big things that kind of look like little missiles, those are projectiles. Those are probably arrows that are being shot. So this is showing a lot of activity. There's a lot of arrows in the air. Okay. Here it shows them, this is a drawing from that last relief. And there's several things here that are of interest. There are Assyrian soldiers who are bringing plunder up to the king. And you can see in the second row on the left, those are Assyrian soldiers bringing carts loaded with stuff. There are also, just below that, there are more carts loaded with stuff that are being brought to the king. Just right from the middle of it, in the first row up, you see two people stretched out. Those are people being tortured. And there is another place. Oh, if you go to the far right on that same row, you see an Assyrian soldier slitting the throat of a guy that's sitting down. Okay, let's go to the next one. Here we see more of that same section. And they are all going toward King Sennacherib on the right-hand side. You can see him sitting in a chair with someone holding a palm leaf or something, over his head. And you see Assyrian soldiers coming up to him, probably receiving rewards for their activity in the combat. Here you can see it. It's a little bit darker. You can see it a little bit better. Behind the king, then, is the tent, which was probably the place from which Sennacherib watched the battle taking place. Here we see a close-up of the engravings. These are three people who were put on stakes. The Assyrians apparently had a means by which they could run a stake up alongside the spine, under the skin, and then the person would be hoisted up into the air. And these three were so treated. Next one. And then this is a close-up of two that have been stretched out, and it's not clear what's being done to them, but it looks like the Assyrian soldier has a knife, and I don't know if he's peeling back the skin or what he's doing, but it doesn't look like fun. Here is a close-up of Sennacherib on his throne. I hope you can see that. On the side of the throne, it is decorated on both sides. It's decorated with these two rows of people. And those are peoples from areas that were conquered by the Assyrians. And so the conquered peoples are kind of his trophy, and they're carried around on his throne that goes with him on his expeditions. Next one. Here you see a close-up of those peoples. Okay, so that was the siege of Lachish. It ended badly for the people of Lachish. And we have reference to Lachish in our text, and I think that that background will help you to understand the situation that Hezekiah finds himself in this chapter. Chapter 36, the first three verses. Now it came about in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a large army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the fuller's field. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. So this is the 14th year of King Hezekiah. So that puts it at about 701 BC. He came to power in 715, we think. So 701, that creates some difficulties, as we will see later on. There is a mention of the Pharaoh of Egypt being, in verse 9, Tirhaka, the king of Cush. As best scholars can figure it out, he did not become the Pharaoh until about 4 or 5 years after this, in about 695 or 6. That has led some people to think that there are actually two different expeditions by the Assyrians that have been crunched together. And they look at the parallel account in 2 Kings 18. 2 Kings 18, I'll read verses 13 through 16. And notice that in this section, verses 14 through 16 are not in the account in Isaiah. The rest of it is virtually identical to what's in Isaiah. So I'll read what has been left out of Isaiah. Now, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So there are some people who have said there are actually two invasions by the Assyrians of Judea. One, they came and took tribute and left. So that would be the account that we have in verses 14 through 16. Then the second one, they come and they take Lachish, want to take Jerusalem, but fail and retreat. I'm inclined to think that it's not two accounts, but rather it's one account. That seems the most straightforward to me. I don't know what to do with the chronological problem of the Pharaoh of Egypt, to the best of our knowledge, not being Pharaoh at the time that we think that this occurred. But the part about that we see in 2 Kings 18, this fits very well with the section that we saw just a couple chapters ago in Isaiah, where it says that the ambassadors were crying in the streets. You remember? And brave men were crying in the streets. And then it talks about the king of Assyria going back on his promises. Well, this fits well then with an interpretation of those sections, that what happened is Judea worked out an agreement with Assyria by giving them a whole bunch of tribute or plunder, whichever, ransom money, that they would leave without destroying Jerusalem, but then went back on their word. I think that's the more likely scenario, but I couldn't say for sure. Okay, so this happens apparently in 701 BC. We have Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, coming against King Hezekiah. And as I've mentioned before, Hezekiah seems to be the one spearheading this alliance against Assyria and spearheading this rebellion. So it seems to be the case that Assyria is particularly targeting Judea in this expedition. Now, the king of Assyria, he sends out his Rav Shekeh. The Rav Shekeh is like, it's the cupbearer. It's the number two man. So he's sending out the number two man in his government to speak to the officials from Jerusalem. And notice, apparently this is a diplomatic convention. It's the Rav Shekeh who is coming, and therefore he will be met not by the king, but by officials from the king. So there are three officials that have been sent by Hezekiah to talk with the Rav Shekeh. The Rav Shekeh comes with a large army in order to show them that they mean business, that they can do some damage, they're capable of doing damage. And they want the people of Jerusalem to be well aware of that. The place that they meet, the upper pool on the highway of the Fuller's Field. We've seen that before. That's the location where Isaiah, for the first time, spoke with Ahaz, way back in chapter 6 or 7. Which is interesting insofar as it was Ahaz who first formed an alliance with Assyria that led to a chain of events that now is bringing them against Jerusalem. Where this is located, this upper pool, is sharply debated. It's not clear. The two best candidates are either in the northwest corner of Jerusalem or in the southeast corner of the city. But they aren't sure. Now, when the Rav Shakeh speaks to these officials, I suspect that the Judean officials are probably standing on the walls of the city. And the Rav Shakeh is coming up to the city and shouting out to him. And the reason I think that is because we'll see later on in the text that there are lots of people listening to this. So whatever is the case, this is being spoken in a way that the people in Jerusalem who are near the walls, they can hear what's going on. Next section. Then Rav Shakeh said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence that you have? I say your counsel and strength for the war are only empty words. Now on whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and has said to Judah and to Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar'? Now, therefore, come make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? And have I now come up without the Lord's approval against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.'" So this is his initial argument. The Rav Shakeh, speaking on behalf of the king of Assyria, and he speaks in first person, and as though he is the king of Assyria. And he addresses Hezekiah. He says, "Say now to Hezekiah." It doesn't say King Hezekiah. It says, "Say now to Hezekiah." From his perspective, there's only one real king. Hezekiah is just a farce. He asks, "Where's your confidence? What makes you think? What gives you any hope that you can survive this? Your counsel and strength for the war are only empty words. You have no capability. It's all talk. It's all hot air. You have no chance against the Assyrian war machine." And notice he says, "Now on whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me?" It's personal. Judea has not rebelled against Assyria. Judea has rebelled against Sennacherib. Now he's going to talk about Egypt, and then he's going to talk about God. Those are the two things that he thinks that Hezekiah might rely on. He's going to do it in that order. Then he's going to come back and talk about Egypt and talk about God again. Okay, with respect to Egypt, he says, "Behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it." Isaiah has said essentially the same thing. Those are words stolen straight from Isaiah, which is interesting. There are a number of indications here that the Assyrians know a lot about what's happening in Judea. They've obviously got spies there. They know what people have been saying, who's been saying what, and they're using that information against Judea. So Egypt is like a crushed reed. It's just going to hurt you. It will be of no help. You rely on it, and it'll end up coming back to bite you. Then, God. If you say, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? Remember, Hezekiah is carrying out reforms. And that includes religious reforms. There are both political reforms and religious reforms taking place. And so it is indeed the case that Hezekiah had been tearing down the high places. And in all likelihood, many of those high places were devoted to Yahweh. But the people of Judea had merged a worship of Baal with Yahweh, using Baalistic rites to worship Yahweh. They weren't worshiping the God of Abraham. They were worshiping the synthetic God that they have created. And he's saying, Hezekiah tore down the high places that were devoted to Yahweh. What makes you think that Yahweh would come to your defense if that's what's happened? Obviously, here he's appealing to that segment of the population that worshiped Yahweh at the high places. Then he turns back to, then he makes this strange offer. He says, now therefore, come make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. In other words, I'll give you 2,000 horses if you can find people that can ride them. Israel is not a horse-riding country. If you'll recall, back in Deuteronomy, God said, I forbid you to multiply horses and chariots. And to a large extent, Israel never did multiply chariots and horses. They did have some. Remember, Solomon collected horses and chariots and built the stables to house them. But by and large, they did not become a nation that has a cavalry that it can bring out in warfare. The Rav Shakeh is taking advantage of that, and he's saying, I'll give you 2,000 horses if you can find riders to put on them, implying you don't have a cavalry. You couldn't even put together a cavalry. We, on the other hand, have a cavalry. So his point seems to be, you are so weak, even with the help of Egypt, you couldn't beat us. He says, how then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? We could send a low-ranking military official out against you and be victorious. You are so weak. And then he comes back to if they're relying in Yahweh. He says, have I now come up without the Lord's approval against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. So now he's saying, Yahweh sent me. What chance do you have? If you're relying on Yahweh to save you, that's ridiculous. I'm here on Yahweh's orders. Again, he's taking words from Isaiah. Isaiah had said that Assyria would come as the tool of God's judgment. Next section. Then Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said to Rab Shakeh, speak now to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. And do not speak with us in Judean, in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. But Rav Shakeh said, has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? So you see what's happening here. The officials, the Judean officials, they're thinking, we don't want what he's saying to be heard by the people of Jerusalem, because he is going to convince many to turn against Hezekiah. So they ask him to speak not in Judean, but speak in Aramaic, which is the diplomatic language of the area. So they say, speak in Aramaic, because we understand that. And the Rav Shakei says, I didn't come to talk just to you. I came to talk to the people. I want them to hear it because they are going to suffer if we come. They are the ones who are doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you. And he wants them to be aware of what's at stake here so that they'll turn against Hezekiah. Interestingly, the Rav Shakei obviously speaks Hebrew, speaks Judean. So Assyria has, they have a lot of knowledge of this area, and they're using it to their advantage. Next section. Then Rav Shakei stood and cried with a loud voice in Judean and said, Hear the words of the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, The Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be given into the hands of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, Make your peace with me and come out to me, and eat each of his vine and each of his fig tree, and drink each of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Beware lest Hezekiah misleads you, saying, The Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? And where have they delivered Samaria? When have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their land from my hand? That the Lord, that is Yahweh, should deliver Jerusalem from my hand. So now the Rav Shakei, he's just speaking to the people. It says he's speaking in Judean. So it's Hebrew, but it's probably the southern dialect. And so he says to them, here's what the king of Assyria says. You need to hear this. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you. There's no way, there's no good reason for his confidence that he can withstand our onslaught. So don't let him deceive you. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. Great phrase. Make you trust in the Lord. Saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. And those would be words that Isaiah is going to speak very soon here and has probably said before. Don't let him deceive you. Don't let him make you trust in Yahweh. He says, don't listen to Hezekiah. Here's the deal. If you make peace with us and you come out, each of you will eat of his vine, each of his fig tree, and drink each from the water of his own cistern. In other words, you can have the food and the water from your land. I'll let you. I'll leave you in peace. And you can do that until I come back for you to take some people and resettle you. Now, they must have known that that was the Assyrian practice. So for the Rav Shakei to deny that would be ludicrous. So they know it's going to happen. But he puts it in its best light. You will be relocated, but you will be relocated to a place where, to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So it's going to be a fertile and productive land. So it won't be so bad. Then he comes back and he says, don't let Hezekiah mislead you, saying the Lord will deliver us. And then he goes on to say, none of the gods of any of the other cities have saved them. And interestingly, he mentions Samaria as one of those. The people in Samaria would have worshipped Yahweh along with other gods, but there would have been people there who would have worshipped Yahweh. And they didn't save their cities. Why would Yahweh be able to serve to save Jerusalem? Next section. But they were silent and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of Rabshakeh. So the officials, the Judean officials, they don't say anything. They're just silent. They, as they were told not to respond, they tear their clothes in mourning, and they go back to report to Hezekiah what the Rabshakeh has said. Okay. I was going to do chapter 37, but that will be difficult. So I think I'm going to stop there, and I'll roll 37 into what I talk about next week. And it'll be the conclusion of this, the attack by the Assyrians. I'll take questions, comments.
So I was kind of confused about the history of, you said that the way you thought that Assyria came in, took tribute from Hezekiah, and then somebody went back on their word. Who went back on their word?
The king of Assyria. He's if it's just one attack, one expedition that's being described, we know from the cylinder that he came, that the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, he comes across into Palestine. He besieges Tyre, which was a Canaanite or Phoenician city. And it was very well fortified. And he took Tyre. Once he took Tyre, then everybody in Palestine was scared to death. And he marches, then Sennacherib starts marching south, taking more and more cities. And what apparently happened is Hezekiah decided, the jig's up, we're dead. It would be best for us to pay him off and save Jerusalem rather than having all of that destroyed. So he sent ambassadors out to negotiate a peace deal with the king of Assyria and paid a huge amount of tribute, including giving his daughters, his harem, and also gold from the temple, doors. All that was stripped off and given to the king of Assyria. All that was given in exchange for the king of Assyria leaving Jerusalem alone. That's apparently what happened. Once Sennacherib had all of that wealth, he said, now I'm coming after Jerusalem. And that's why in chapter 33, verses 7 and 8, it says, behold, their brave men cry in the streets. The ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. So that's apparently in response to this going back on the agreement that had been made. And then it goes on and says, the highways are desolate. The traveler has ceased. He, that's the king of Assyria, has broken the covenant. He has despised the witnesses. He has no regard for man. So there must have been witnesses there to the agreement, and he's just ignoring all of that.
And so in the end, he comes, after breaking his agreement, he comes down and he takes Lachish, and he's got it. So he's got all the gold and all that from what Hezekiah had sent. Then he takes Lachish, and that's all. So that prism that he wrote, that's all that was included there.
Right.
And it didn't include how he went on to Jerusalem
and
died.
Right. Gotcha. Right. And he could have collected the tribute while Lachish was under siege. It could have been it could have been that the siege was far enough along that the writing was on the wall. I don't know, but that's possible.
It sort of strikes me that this could be a reflection or kind of a preview of what faces us when our culture turns actively hostile to the public gathering of Christians and open teaching of the gospel. I'm imagining having one of those Assyrian officials standing in the front of the room there, all dressed in his battle gear, saying, look, This is reality. You either come over and stop being such a pain in the ass, or you're dead. That's your choice. Are you going to trust in this invisible God, this Jesus that nobody's seen for 2,000 years?
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what do we have inside us?
Yeah, the thing that's interesting about this account is, who are you going to believe? For the people sitting on the wall, who are you going to believe? Because it looks like Assyria is, that there is no stopping it. And seeing what they've done in other cities, it has to be terrifying to know what could be out there. What probably will happen. I mean, if you're a betting man, you're going to bet on Assyria. So do we believe the Rav Shakeh, or do we believe Isaiah? And that's essentially the choice that they have to make. And it really looks like believing Isaiah is absurd. And that's what's phenomenal about this whole account. I mean, all of Isaiah up to now, the question is, why should we believe him? And I think that the only answer that I can think of that really is satisfying to me is, Isaiah is saying the kinds of things that the God of Abraham would say. That he's representing the God who is there. Other voices are not representing the God who is there. If that's true, then it is critical for us to learn to recognize the God, the voice of the God who is there. That understanding who God is, what he's about, what kinds of things he does, what kinds of things he doesn't do, is going to be absolutely critical in order to sort out the different voices that are out there and to know which ones to listen to and which ones not to listen to. I think that's an amazing challenge before us. That's not to say that we're all on our own. I mean, God's a very creative God. He's the one who brought us to him in the first place, and he'll bring us along. So he's playing a huge role in that. But there's still our responsibility, and our responsibility is to learn to recognize God's voice.
I'm behind on the online recordings, so could you summarize for us what Isaiah has promised?
Well, that's what's, I think that's very interesting, because most of what Isaiah has been saying is with respect to the distant future. It's not with respect to this particular incident. What he's been saying is, God wants to save and is eager to do so, eager to pour out his grace. He just needs you to listen. He just needs you to repent. But he's eager and willing to provide salvation. That's basically what he's been saying in lots of different ways. And ultimately, he will save the remnant. He will save those who turn to him. But specifically with respect to Assyria, what promises he's made in this expedition, very little. He will make a promise in this next chapter. And he has told Hezekiah, don't give in to them, that God will protect you. Probably they have. Probably the people have heard that. Because apparently what Isaiah is telling the king and his officials is getting spread throughout Jerusalem.
You say we must begin to understand how to hear God's voice in this kind of hubbub of our current age. We venture into the Old Testament. So that's kind of point number one. That's the foundation of what I think I heard you say, and I'm going to add another thing to it, which is typically how I approach these questions, things which throws a lot of people off. But I'm trying to explain it now explicitly so no one, people can follow me.
Okay.
First establishment, we need to learn to hear God's voice.
Okay. The word I used is recognize God's voice.
Recognize God's voice, even better. So recognize God's voice with this idea that there are many compelling directions we can go. There are many forces pressuring us to go various directions. But we need to recognize God's voice. Now, it is one of those analogies that I find remarkably easy to say, but extraordinarily difficult to explain or implement.
Okay.
In the sense of, well, maybe you can go from there. You feel good, or do you want me to keep going?
I feel good.
Okay, you want to keep going? Go.
Well, let me. I have talked about this at other times, but I think it's really helpful. When Jesus came, he was God incarnate. And I find it interesting that the people who knew the Bible best didn't recognize him. I think the reason for that is they weren't looking at the Bible to figure out who God is. They were looking at the Bible for other purposes. That is, what do I have to do to look righteous? But presumably, anybody who understood who God is, that is, the Creator God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, anybody who had really made a serious effort to figure out who that God is, what kind of person he is, would have looked at Jesus and said, oh my goodness, I've seen him before somewhere. That there's something about what he said, about the way he carried himself, everything would have been very godlike, very like the God that we know. And so I think what's incumbent upon us, what we have to do is study who God is and think about that and process that through such that whatever disguise he's wearing, we can see him.
Let me see if I understand what you just said. And I'm going to say it purposely. I'm going to re-say what you said in a manner purposely to obscure what you said. The okay. People who understood the Bible the best failed to recognize Jesus because they were looking for a version of God that they thought they should get. And your rebuttal or advice against that is the same thing.
No.
Okay, keep going.
They were not, I would say they weren't studying the Bible. They were reading it, memorizing it. They were doing various things with it. But they were not looking at the Bible in order to understand what the Bible was saying. You see the distinction I'm making? I mean, it's possible. I think we all know it's possible to study the Bible and be absolutely ignorant of what it says. I mean, you have to make it an effort. You have to have the right goal in mind. And the right goal is what was the author trying to say?
My difficulty obviously comes about in, you know, we've established that now. Would you want something else?
A little more.
Keep going.
No, I want a little more from you.
And this is it. So we identify so quickly with the Israelites, I think, mostly because we largely seem to live in fear as human beings. Fear of oppression or fear of death or fear of God turning his back against us, etc. It's our implicit kinship with the Jews and their trodden on nature and their fear that I am most suspicious of. And so your advice to study the Bible, while I'm not at all dismissing it, I think it's remarkably important. It is the very thing that provides a language for what we who are sanctified experience. But it feels only as valuable as we as experience God. And I don't mean that in a mystic sense or in a universalist sense. I mean that specifically in the sense that it's Isaiah's kind of prodding. Isaiah's not saying know the Bible as much as he's also saying, I mean, know your God. Like, and it strikes me that, yes, studying the Bible is very useful for, coming back to the first point, recognizing God's voice. But living out the faith, I mean, praying ceaselessly as we exist, like coming to a personal faith, coming to a personal almost Phil said personal relationship with God. That'd be so embarrassing. coming to terms with our sanctification in the sense that the terror that God pours into our lives is there precisely for our edification. Seems like just as important as sound biblical scholarship. Like that real nitty-gritty invisible thing that I couldn't help you do or couldn't convey to you. Like, but still should be emphasized. Like, I love what you're saying. I agree that the Bible's remarkably important, but I know tons of people like you do who know the Bible who I wouldn't trust with my kids. So at the end of the day, that absolutely committedness to one's own being, to becoming in the Kierkegaardian sense, that's got to be mentioned, right? I mean, you can know the Bible all day long, but if you're not praying ceaselessly, I don't know what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. That it's, if it were possible to study the Bible and have no experience of life, one wouldn't understand much.
Okay.
That God is dealing with us. We have direct revelation in Scripture, but through our experience and everything that we go through in life, that too is a form of communication from God. He's the author of it, and he's working on us at that level as well. And that can be at least as profound and helpful, if not more profound and helpful than Scripture. The nice thing about Scripture is we have things being said to us. We have words that we can think about and work with. And
it makes explicit what is implicitly happening to us.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
But in that sense, what marvelous freedom we're given then. What marvelous excitement it is to be alive. Like heaven forbid we be paralyzed by fear, or heaven forbid we question tomorrow. I mean, like, the whole shoveling smoke metaphor makes a heck of a lot of sense to me. And I love my kids, and I just was in a motorcycle accident, so I'm doing a lot of processing about my own mortality and saying goodbye to people. But I feel like the good news of the Bible is a great thing. I mean, that if we are seeking sanctification and God has granted it to us, what a marvelous thing it is to be here. What a marvelous thing it is to sit in pews and suffer and endure and have friendships and be betrayed, but at the same time to restore. Like, I just, it's good to be human, I suppose. And in this way, just to be a humanist on this earth, to feel one's humanness most profoundly before one's God, all the elements of the Bible that have come together for me almost have come in reverse order. I haven't read a passage and it made sense. I had to understand my inherent sinfulness first before I understood John 3:16.
Mm-hmm.
So that we would go forward and live, and that we would go forward and be human beings and love. Like, and I'm not getting too quasi hippie on you people, but I'm just simply saying that, like, it is through trials and tribulations and joys that I understand more of the Bible than I do from any sort of scholastic thing.
Right. Right. That's absolutely true. And there is a sense in which there is nothing that we should be fearful of. But being human beings, that's a tough, in the face of some things, that's tough. If we were living in Lakish and we see the siege engines coming, it would be difficult to be content and be happy. Okay, thanks.